Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. In a few minutes' time, we'll remember the basketball great Kobe Bryant, who's been killed in a helicopter crash. He was 41 years old. But our top story today is the outbreak of a new respiratory virus in China. It is spreading faster than before, and measures to contain it, such as travel restrictions, have been stepped up. That's according to senior Chinese officials, who've now extended the New Year holiday until February the 2nd. It was due to end this Thursday. 56 people have died so far out of a total of nearly 2,000 confirmed cases. Scientists say the new coronavirus is also infectious during incubation, meaning people can transmit the illness before showing any symptoms, something that wasn't true of SARS, for example. Well, the head of the World Health Organization is on his way to Beijing to discuss the outbreak with the government. We'll talk to them in a moment about what we know for sure about the virus, and to America's leading disease control expert about efforts to produce a vaccine. But first, let's hear from the centre of the outbreak, the city of Wuhan. Chris Buckley of the New York Times is there.
The city has been extraordinarily quiet, but this Sunday was even more quiet because overnight the authorities announced traffic controls across the city. Most residents stayed off the road, so you could walk around neighbourhoods and see very few cars. People are walking or biking to shops to stock up on fresh food, lining up in front of pharmacies, which had run out of gloves and antiseptics and other supplies that people are wanting.
And what about at the hospitals? Have you managed to get out to any hospitals today? And what's the situation like there?
I managed to get to one hospital, Wuhan University People's Hospital, or Renmin Hospital. And there were very few people at the fever clinic there. That hospital isn't one of the seven big designated hospitals that are supposed to take in suspected cases of infection by the virus. And nonetheless, in previous days, the fever clinic there was quite busy.
And in terms of supplies, I mean, we were talking a few days ago about medical supplies being running short. Have they managed to sort that out? Have they managed to get more masks and so on into the city?
There's a very mixed picture there. The government says that they're coming in and more supplies are arriving. That may well be true, but there is a desperate need for those supplies here, in particular among medical staff who need the topmost protection so they can deal with patients who may have the coronavirus. A lot of those supplies, like gloves and masks and protective gowns, can't be used repeatedly. So the demand from doctors in particular is very high. And then, of course, a lot of residents are also trying to stock up on the better quality masks as well.
And in terms of where we're at with the spread of the virus, what are officials saying? Because, it's certainly getting worse, not better, isn't it?
It does sound like the government is digging in for a longer fight, and it does sound like they're expecting it, that at least in the short term, there's going to be a continued rise in the number of cases.
But no panic in Wuhan.
I wouldn't call it panic. There is a subcurrent of anxiety. You will talk to people who are quite calm, but if you raise certain issues, flashes of anger will come up, especially toward the local government, with many people believing that it didn't speak candidly soon enough and it lulled people into thinking that this was a minor problem. At the same time, there's a sort of a stoic fortitude among people as well.
To that extent, I mean, is the holiday period helping? Because, you know, people aren't expecting to do quite as much as they might otherwise be doing.
I think that's true. I think the next week over the Lunar New Year holiday offers a kind of limited respite for the government, in that in ordinary times, many people would be taking this week off anyway, and many of them might be staying close to home as well. The big problem probably emerges toward the end of the holiday, when people will be under pressure or expectations to return to work. It's going to be very testing, no doubt, for the government and for people.
Chris Buckley. Well, I've also been speaking to Dr. Abdi Mohammed at the Health Emergencies Programme of the World Health Organization. I asked him about what's now known about the source of the outbreak.
All the epidemiological investigation points that it could be an animal source, but we don't have a definitive answer to that question.
So when the Chinese authorities say they think it may be an animal source, but an animal from one of the markets in Wuhan and a wild animal at that. Is that plausible?
It's plausible, but we don't know the intermediate animal before it jumped to human being.
And what about the way that the virus is transmitted? Again, the Chinese authorities saying they think it can be transmitted during incubation. In other words, when people aren't showing any symptoms. How worrying is that?
It could be potential, but we really don't know. So far, of the available information we had, especially when it spread to rest of the world, was patients were presented with symptoms. But as I said earlier, there are a lot of unknowns, and we are working closely with the Chinese authority to get a deeper understanding of the available clinical and epidemiological data.
But in general terms, when you're dealing with these sorts of viruses, how much more complicated do things become if they can be transmitted when people aren't showing symptoms? I mean, I imagine much more complicated, right?
It does, but if this virus behaves like other coronaviruses, hopefully that will have more symptomatic presentation. It's like a flu, and a lot of the preventive measures still remains.
You talked about cooperation with your Chinese counterparts, Chinese officials. Are you getting full cooperation?
As of now, all the available information, we had a high-level mission we visited in Wuhan, and there's a very close collaboration at all levels with the Chinese authority.
At this stage, is it any more deadly than influenza in terms of the number of fatalities relative to the number of infections?
Compared to other respiratory, it's not as severe as MERS, where it can kill 35% of those patients, and it has not reached the SARS level. But we are in the early stage, and we don't know how this virus is going to behave. From the available information we have, it is around 2-4% of patients who have died so far. And most of those patients had underlying chronic condition that made the immune system weaker.
You mentioned MERS and SARS, but what about just seasonal influenza? I'm just curious, what's the sort of fatality rate for seasonal influenza?
Seasonal influenza, it depending on where and which country it's affecting, but it's quite variable. Seasonal influenza can go easily from one person to another, that affecting a lot of huge people. Like the latest information from the US, we had 15 million people infected with seasonal influenza. 7 million of them have sector healthcare, and around 8,000 of them have died. So because of the ease of transmissibility, when you look at coronaviruses, that ease of sustained human-to-human transmission have not reached. While the case fatality rate may be high, the ease that it's spreading from one human to human, we have not reached that level.
Abdi Mohammed. Well, China's Center for Disease Prevention says it's working on a vaccine. Now they've identified the strain of coronavirus. And so are other laboratories around the world, including in the US. I've been talking to Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and asked him first to explain the significance of isolating this new strain.
Well, when you isolate the virus, you do what's called genetic sequencing. And genetic sequencing gives you the entire blueprint of the virus. When you put that on a public database, investigators anywhere can access that database and pull out the gene that would code for the particular protein that you want your vaccine to be. So unlike in previous era, where you would need the actual virus itself to develop a vaccine with, right now, all you need is the genetic sequence, because you want to do some recombinant DNA technology, which really means that you specifically want the body to make a response against a particular protein, which you know is the protein that when you make a response against it, you can protect the body against infection. So really, that's what it means when you get the virus and you publish the sequence of the particular strain.
Which sounds good, but I imagine that going from that to developing the vaccine, testing it and so on, that's a much longer process, right?
Well, let me tell you where we are right now. What we are doing here at the National Institutes of Health, we're doing the following in collaboration with a company who uses what's called a messenger RNA platform to develop vaccine. We have the sequence. We're developing the vaccine now. And we anticipate that without any glitches, which I hope there won't be, I don't think there'll be, that we'll be able to get this particular candidate into a human trial, phase one it's called, because it's very early trial for safety, in a limited number of people, about 20 to 25 people, within the next 3 months. From that time, it would take about an additional 3 months to determine early safety data, plus whether it induces a response that you would predict would be protective. Now, that's a big difference between doing a phase one trial, which is the first step towards developing a vaccine, and having a vaccine in enough doses to be able to utilize. That second process would take many more months and probably up to a year. So the good news is that we can get into people within 3 months. But the, you know, somewhat sobering news is that we're not going to have a vaccine available for a considerable period of time, probably even in an emergency basis, within a year.
And without wanting to be glib, I mean, it could all be over by then.
That's absolutely correct. And that's the reason why when you do a vaccine development, you're doing it at risk, because you have to make a major investment in time and in resources without necessarily knowing you're going to have a vaccine that you could use. We were left with the same situation with SARS back in 2002, where we developed a vaccine, and by the time we had it, the good public health measures actually brought the outbreak to an end. Quite frankly, I hope that that's what happens here, but if it doesn't, then at least you're well on the way to developing a vaccine, which is why we're doing it, even though there's no guarantee that we'll have to use it.
And just one final thought. I mean, given that you have all this genetic information, is there some sort of universal vaccine for these sorts of viruses that might be developed that could at least do something to protect people in case of future outbreaks?
That is a very good question and a very good point. In fact, we are trying to do that with influenza. And you may have heard, because I've spoken about that a lot, about our now very large effort to try and develop a universal influenza vaccine so that you don't have to keep chasing after the different strains. Your point about a universal vaccine for coronavirus was not entertained, because in general, coronaviruses cause about 10 to 30% of the common cold. But given the fact that historically we now have SARS in 2002, MERS in 2012, and now we have this new novel coronavirus in 2019-20, there really is now a good reason to seriously consider trying to make a universal corona vaccine.
Dr. Anthony Fauci speaking to me from Washington. Still to come on NewsHour, Israel allows its citizens to travel to Saudi Arabia. What does it say about relations between the two?
It's not going to happen in one go. It's going to be, you know, a bunch of small steps. And I think that we're seeing them. And what's significant about this one is that it's Saudi Arabia, because that's the most important country in the Persian Gulf. Up until now, we've had some steps with Bahrain, with the United Arab Emirates, but not so much with the Saudis.
More on that coming up a little later in the program, in about 15 minutes' time. But let's just recap our headlines from the BBC newsroom this hour. One of the greatest legends in the world of basketball, Kobe Bryant, has died in a helicopter crash in the United States. More on that in a moment. China's extending its Lunar New Year holiday until the 2nd of February to help control the coronavirus outbreak. And polling stations in Peru are closing in a general election 4 months after Congress was dissolved by the president. More on that too later in the program. This is James Menendez with NewsHour live from the BBC. And some sad news in the past hour. It's been confirmed that one of the greatest basketball players of all time, Kobe Bryant, has been killed in a helicopter crash in California. 4 others also died. He spent all his career at the LA Lakers, taking them to 5 NBA championships. Let's talk to senior NBA reporter at The Athletic, Sam Amick, who knew Kobe Bryant and joins me live on the line from Sacramento in California. Thank you very much for being with us. First of all, your reaction to this news.
James, thank you for having me. Stunned like so many others, still processing it. I mean, I covered Kobe very in depth for a lot of years, and it just, it's hard to put into words. This is a guy who obviously basketball wise was one of a kind, but within recent years, the part that I certainly had enjoyed was seeing the way that he had tried to transform himself. And it just, your heart goes out to him, to his family, and multiple reports that his daughter, Gianna, who's 13 years old, was in this accident as well. It's just, it's very hard to put into words.
Yes, those reports haven't been confirmed yet, but that does seem to be the case. And she was a very keen basketball player too, is that right?
Yes, in fact, it's quite incredible to think about some of the imagery and the stories coming out of the kind of Kobe and his family within even the past couple of months. We saw videos recently of he and his daughter sitting at Lakers games, just absolutely, adorable, kind of heartwarming stuff where he would sit there and talk with her about the game courtside at Lakers games. Those reports you mentioned also had indicated that they were going to, he has an academy, the Mamba Sports Academy in Southern California, where they would routinely go train, and he was coaching his daughter's basketball team. And that was, one of the many things he did in his retirement after hanging up his own sneakers. And so that relationship obviously was deep and, and again, hard to process.
Yes, and leaving behind a wife and three other children, I think. Sam, what made him such a great player?
His relentlessness, that's the word that comes to mind for me. It sounds cliche because pro athletes, by and large, work very hard. Kobe, I would put him up there with any other athlete in any sport for all of time when it comes to the absolute relentlessness with which he approached his craft, because you would always hear stories from his teammates about how they simply couldn't live up to his standards. He would get into the gym long before them. They might show up at 6 a.m. and feel pretty good about themselves, only to find out that Kobe had been back in the weight room at 4:30. It was very Michael Jordan-esque. That was certainly a guy who he looked up to and modeled much of his game after as a kid growing up in Philadelphia. So the work ethic combined with just a pursuit, again, relentlessly for not only individual greatness, but he wanted to be known as a champion. So 5 champions or championships and doing it with Shaquille O'Neal in the first iteration, and then, taking it very personally on the back end of his career to do it in a different fashion, with Pau Gasol and by his side, and Shaquille O'Neal long since gone. He wanted to show the world that he didn't need Shaq to win championships. And so it's just incredibly accomplished.
Yeah. And then just 30 seconds, if you can. And as a man, how did you find him?
I found him inquisitive, just curious to the world around him, and complicated. We need to certainly acknowledge that, Kobe had, the dark chapter of the rape allegations in Colorado so many years ago that, where the world had a front row seat to seeing him navigate those waters that were extremely tricky. You see where he was late in his life with his daughters and extremely supportive of female empowerment and going down these roads. So complicated in some form, but curious and relentless, and just going to be sorely, sorely missed.
Thank you very much indeed. That was Sam Amick, senior NBA reporter at The Athletic, remembering Kobe Bryant, who's died at the age of 41. It's often forgotten that during the Second World War, many Germans risked their lives to help those whose lives were threatened by the Nazis. Among them, Elisabeth Charlotte Glurden, known as Lieselotte or Lilo, who along with her husband Erich hid Jews at their home in Berlin before arranging safe passage. The couple's efforts went undetected until 1944, when they took in General Fritz Lindemann, who has been hunted by the Gestapo for his part in the plot to assassinate Hitler. They stood trial in November 1944. The BBC's Fergal Keane reports.
The Glodens lived here in a comfortable flat in this apartment block. Erich, the architect, his mother-in-law Elisabeth, and his wife Lieselotte, or Lilo. She's why I've come here. A face staring out at me from an old book, dark-haired, bright-eyed and smiling. A photo from before the catastrophe, from before her remarkable journey of resistance. Lilo Glodden came of age in Cologne during the years of the Weimar Republic. Her father was a Jewish doctor, her mother a noblewoman. In this cultured milieu, Lilo learned the piano. She travelled around Europe and studied to become a lawyer, until disaster struck.
The tremendous crowds which you see gathered outside the stock exchange are due to the greatest crash in the history of the New York Stock Exchange.
The Wall Street crash in October 1929 and resulting Great Depression devastated Germany. 6 million people, 40% of the working population, became jobless. The beneficiaries were the Nazis and their leader Adolf Hitler. By 1933, he was Germany's chancellor. Amid rising anti-Semitism, Jews like Lilo's father were driven from their jobs, and Lilo, as a half-Jew and woman, was forced out of the legal profession. In 1938, Lilo married the architect Erich Gloden, 15 years older, like her, half-Jewish, but with an Aryan surname. They could have used the protection of his name to keep a low profile and wait for the war to end. But instead, they chose to resist Hitler by hiding and feeding Jews. The Gloden's niece, Inge Schroeter, recalled.
He sold possessions for them and, with the money, bought them food and other things needed for their underground life.
The dawn of June the 6th comes up like thunder over the invasion coast as Allied heavy and medium bombers following in the wake of Bomber Command.
By July 1944, the war had turned decisively against the Nazis and a group of German officers tried to kill Hitler.
Operations room, Hitler's headquarters, following the attempt on the Führer's life. Conjecture runs high as to whether in fact...
One of the plotters, General Fritz Lindemann, was fleeing for his life, and the political underground sent him to the Gloden's apartment in Berlin. Hiding him meant certain death if they were discovered.
Blown out of the windows by the bomb. A black-cloaked Hitler.
The newsreels rallied support for Hitler, and after 5 weeks, the Glodens were given away. A careless resistance member told friends who told the Gestapo. A friend of Lilo's, Josef von Koskel, was present when the Gestapo arrived.
Mr. Gloden opened the door. A moment later, I heard a clatter of voices and clapping blows. "You pig! Where is Lindemann?" shouted several voices. Within seconds, I realised what was happening. The Gestapo was there. "Goodbye, beautiful life," was my first thought.
The Glodens were sentenced to be beheaded, to die on the guillotine. And they were killed, all within the same half hour, on the morning of November 30th, 1944. Lilo took a stand that she knew could cost her her life. And with her husband Erich and mother Elizabeth, she showed the courage that's possible when confronted with evil. That is an example that is timeless and universal.
This is NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. I'm James Menendez. Let's head to Israel now, because today the government has announced that Israelis wanting to travel to Saudi Arabia, either on business or on pilgrimage, can go freely. There's been no reciprocal announcement from Riyadh. The two countries don't have diplomatic relations, but they have been growing closer in recent months because of a mutual interest in deterring Iranian ambitions in the region. I've been speaking to Herb Kainon, who's senior diplomatic analyst at the Jerusalem Post. How significant is this move?
I think it's greatly significant. I think it's a small step, but it's one of a number of baby steps that has been taken place over the last couple of years between Israel and the Persian Gulf countries, kind of normalizing ties. It's not going to happen at one go. It's going to be, you know, a bunch of small steps. And I think that we're seeing them. And what's significant about this one is that it's Saudi Arabia, because that's the most important country in the Persian Gulf. Up until now, we've had some steps with Bahrain, with the United Arab Emirates, but not so much with the Saudis. So in that sense, this is highly significant, I think.
And what does it mean in practice? I mean, at the moment, who are the Israelis who are going to Saudi Arabia? Is it Arab Israelis going on pilgrimages?
For the most part, it's Arab Israelis going on pilgrimages. But according to this directive now, it will also enable Israeli businessmen to travel to Saudi Arabia under their own passports. And there's a message there. I mean, Israeli businessmen have gone to Saudi Arabia in the past, but it's always been under a foreign passport. The fact that they're allowing, you know, Israelis to come in under their own passport, Israeli Jews is something we haven't seen before. And taken in the whole span of relations between us, or the lack of relations between us, that's a big move. I mean, you have to remember that, you know, up until a couple of years ago, Israeli Jews couldn't even fly over Saudi airspace to and from Israel. And that was, you know, that was a big change. So now when you have them say, well, you can actually come into our country, maybe not hordes of tourists, but at least businessmen, that's a start.
Yes, I mean, at the moment, it seems hard to imagine Israeli tourists either being allowed to go, I guess, or wanting to go. Is that fair?
I don't see the Saudis opening their gates right now to Israeli tourists. I think we have to, you know, we have to look at this as a marathon, not a sprint. And it's going to be small baby steps. And we've seen these baby steps over the last 2 years, one after the other. And I think what it's trying to do, or the reason the Persian Gulf states are doing it this way, is because they want to habituate their publics to the idea of dealing with a country that for so long they've said that they can't deal with.
And this is Iran effectively bringing Israel and Saudi Arabia together, or at least a shared animosity towards Iran.
Right. I think what you have is shared threats. You've got Iran as a shared threat, and you've got radical Islam as a shared threat. And that's definitely what's bringing the two countries together. Look, I mean, the Saudis haven't fallen in love with Israel, but they realize the utility of Israel in their dealing with Iran. They also realize that the biggest threat to Saudi Arabia right now is not coming from Jerusalem. It's coming from Tehran, right? It's not Jerusalem that's flying missiles into Saudi Arabia. It's Tehran through the Houthis. So that's what's brought us together. So now there's a great deal of cooperation, apparently, that's been taking place, you know, underneath the table between the governments. Now, maybe this is a start to bring that stuff that's been happening under the water up above the surface.
And just one final thought. We're expecting the White House to unveil its Middle East peace plan in the next few days. Is Saudi Arabia likely to lend its support to that, or is that, again, a step too far?
Look, again, I don't think you're gonna see a situation where Trump is going to announce the plan and the Saudis are going to open up the champagne bottles. But I think that you might see some statements coming out of Riyadh that could be interpreted as seeing the glass half full. This definitely was not done without Saudi knowledge or the knowledge of the U.S. Allies in the Arab world. They know about it. They know what's in the plan. So nobody's going to be taken by surprise from it. And I think what the Americans are expecting is that they just don't dismiss it completely out of hand. And considering the geopolitical situation in the region with Iran, right, I'd imagine that's a pretty safe bet because the Persian Gulf countries and the Saudis, they kind of want America on their side now as well. So they might not love it, but they might not reject it to the degree that we would have seen perhaps 5 or 10 years ago.
That was Herb Kynan of the Jerusalem Post. The small Scottish island of North Ronaldsay of Orkney is home to just 50 people and 2,000 sheep. And not just any sheep. The North Ronaldsay ruminants have been grazing the shoreline for thousands of years. And since the mid-19th century, they've been existing exclusively on seaweed that they forage from the beach. Scientists have now become extremely interested in how the sheep digest the seaweed, because apparently they emit far less methane than livestock eating ordinary feed, meaning they're better for the environment. Emma Jane Kirby reports.
So this is the famous seaweed that the sheep feed on.
You can see some seaweed washed up here.
There are two things you need to know about North Ronaldsay. One, that the timorous sheep will do everything to avoid you. And two, that the all-prevailing wind will do its level best to knock you off your feet. Sheep farmer Alison Duncan has lived on the island for 34 years with her flock of 100 ewes and their myriad offspring.
Have a look round the corner, see if there's any more sheep there.
But the one thing she never does is feed them, because these sheep subsist solely on the seaweed they forage from the beach.
I think people think seaweed's not very nutritious, but the sheep do get quite fat in it. They're at their fattest in winter. They get plenty feeding during that time. There's plenty seaweed washed up. And it's winter when we send them off. They don't go to the slaughterhouse till they're 3, 4 years old. They have quite a good life first.
The seaweed diet changed the quality of their meat, apparently making it, I'm vegetarian, more gamey. It's now a sought-after delicacy and was served to the Queen at her Diamond Jubilee. Scientists have recently realised that the North Ronaldsay sheep could provide the answer to greener farming.
quite a technological advancement as far as they go.
David Beattie is spending the next 3 years studying how protein-rich seaweed can be introduced into general livestock feed.
We're going here first, so this is a small lab that we have.
Part of a knowledge transfer partnership which couples an academic institute with an industry body, David is dividing his time here at Davidson's Animal Feeds just outside Glasgow and at his research base, the Hatton Institute in Dundee.
It smells like a rabbit hutch in here.
That's the molasses that we add to the feeds.
And the reason David believes ruminants should eat more seaweed is because it could reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Studies have shown when a North Ronaldsey sheep digests its seaweed diet, it emits far less methane than ordinary stock animals.
One of the unfortunate consequences of the way that ruminants digest their feed is that when they break down components of the feed, a percentage of that feed is then converted into methane gas, which is a potent greenhouse gas. In Britain, I believe that by some estimations, up to 15% of our greenhouse gas emissions come from the livestock sector. So when you feed a wide variety of seaweed, it's not just one species, to ruminants, you actually see a correlated drop, drastically reducing the amount of methane that they produce.
So this is the area where our articulated trucks are loaded. I'll take you up the stairs.
And if David succeeds in creating a nutritious seaweed blend that's palatable to ordinary livestock, there'd be other environmental benefits too, including sourcing more animal feed locally and in a more sustainable way.
So a large proportion of the oilseed that we use comes from South America. This obviously has some negative implications on the environment, both in the method used to farm those products and in the transportation across continent.
So we really can learn something from the North Ronaldsey sheep?
I'd say we absolutely can.
David Beattie ending that report by Emma Jane Kirby. Time to head to Peru now, because people there have been voting today to elect a new Congress. They weren't expecting to go to the polls until next year, but 4 months ago, the president dissolved Congress, accusing members of blocking his efforts to tackle corruption. That's plagued Peruvian politics. The last four presidents were all involved in corruption scandals. One ended up taking his own life just before he was about to be arrested. I've been talking to Latin America expert Michael Shifter of the Washington think tank, the Inter-American Dialogue. He's been telling me more about why these elections were needed in the first place.
Well, what happened is that Martin Vizcarra, who was the current president, became president because the president before him, Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, was forced to resign because of corruption charges. And Vizcarra came to be president with a very strong anti-corruption agenda. And he got fierce opposition from the Congress, especially from a party that was led by the Alberto Fujimori's daughter, Keiko Fujimori, called Popular Force. And there was total gridlock, and he was unable to make any progress. He decided to dissolve the Congress last September. It was a bit of a controversial decision. There were constitutional experts that had different views on it, but it was affirmed by the Constitutional Court last week. And the idea was to dissolve the Congress and to call new elections, parliamentary elections, to see whether a new Congress would be able to be more cooperative in pursuing this anti-corruption agenda.
And interesting the way you phrase that, because is there any reason to suppose that the new Congress will be more willing to go along with that agenda?
Well, I think we can expect there'll certainly be less resistance from Popular Force, that is the party of Keiko Fujimori. The question is whether this very fragmented party system, and there's certainly no guarantee that the next Congress is going to be more sympathetic or be able to work more productively with President Vizcarra. So this is a huge gamble on his part. And certainly the names that we see as candidates are not terribly reassuring and don't arouse a lot of enthusiasm among Peruvian voters.
Yes, I mean, they must be a bit sick of all this. I mean, not just the issues, but how many times they've got to vote. And in fact, this Congress will only sit for a year, won't it?
Yeah, a bit over a year. The elections for president will be in April 2021. So it's a bit over a year. And of course, as soon as this election takes place, people will be starting to looking to 2021. Vizcarra cannot cannot run again and will not run again. So many of the people who presented themselves as candidates are trying to position themselves for the presidential race.
And what exactly does he want to do when it comes to, I mean, it's such a big issue, but tackling corruption? Are there specific things he thinks will make a difference?
Well, one of the key points on his agenda is, for example, to lift the immunity that members of Congress have for prosecution. Currently, if you're a member of Congress, you're completely protected. And he wants to change that. And he also wants to talk about that they non-reelection for members of Congress. So there are a variety of reforms that he has put forward, but that really haven't gotten anywhere. And he's hoping that a new Congress will go along with him and be more supportive.
And a quick word on Keiko Fujimori. She's waiting to go on trial, as I understand it. I mean, is that going to happen?
Well, I think it will. It will happen. And the judicial system is not a model of efficiency in Peru, but could take some time, but I think it will happen. And of course, she has alleged that the charges against her are all political. Charges are that she accepted money from the Brazilian construction company Odebrecht.
Michael Schifter, speaking to me from Washington, D.C. You're listening to NewsHour. A reminder of our top story today on NewsHour. China's extending its Lunar New Year holiday in an attempt to contain the coronavirus outbreak that's killed 56 people and infected nearly 2,000 others. Scientists say they're working on a vaccine, but Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in Washington says developing a vaccine will not be quick.
The good news is that we can get into people within 3 months. But the, you know, somewhat sobering news is that we're not going to have a vaccine available for a considerable period of time, probably even in an emergency basis, within a year.
Also today, one of the legends of basketball, Kobe Bryant, has died in a helicopter crash in the United States. He was 41, and it's just been confirmed that his teenage daughter, Gianna, was also one of those who died on board that helicopter. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. Now, do elite universities offer a route to high achievement for the best minds from all backgrounds, or do they simply entrench privilege and hamper social mobility? The recent admissions scandal in the US that saw a TV star jailed for paying someone to change the answers on her daughter's entry exam confirmed many people's long-standing suspicion that top institutions are only for the rich and successful, either by legitimate or illegitimate means. Add to that a divisive political climate in the US and elsewhere, in which experts are often derided and senior government advisers are perfectly comfortable talking about alternative facts. And it all feels like the big academic institutions are on the back foot. Well, this weekend, the head of one of the world's most prestigious universities, Harvard, has been giving a lecture at another equally well-regarded institution, Cambridge University, called the Research University in Contentious Times. Well, he's Harvard President Larry Barker. And when he came into the NewsHour studio, I asked him first, what is the purpose of somewhere like Harvard in these polarized times?
I think we have a number of obligations. You know, I like to make a distinction between truth and facts. Facts are incontrovertible, or at least they used to be.
Not according to some people these days.
Understood. But all the more reason for institutions like ours to stand up for facts. By contrast, truth is something that needs to be tested. It needs to be discovered. And that can only be done if one is willing to embrace ideas which may be at odds with one's own. And so I think institutions like ours have an obligation to create forums in which people can come and debate the great ideas of our time.
Is that happening, though? Because as you well know, there have been accusations that many elite universities have a strong liberal bias. Is that vigorous debate of ideas happening?
I think it is. I think in many cases there is some inclination to lean left, but that imposes upon us an obligation to work hard to bring people together.
And why do you think that happens? I mean, because this goes to the heart of what many political scientists are thinking about, the divide between graduates and non-graduates and the way they vote.
Right.
I mean, is it a truism to say that if you're more educated, you're more likely to swing left?
I'm not sure that's true. You know, I spend a lot of time in Washington, D.C. I meet with members of Congress. And when I go there, I sometimes encounter this point of view. And I often point out, especially to those in the United States Senate, you know, the Senate has 100 members, 15 of whom are Harvard alumni. Of the 15, 9 of them are Republicans, 6 of them are Democrats.
Those are people who went to the university. What about within the university, teaching staff, for example, though? Because that, you know, that's where the debates happen, isn't it?
Well, it's where the debates happen. But my point is that for those who think that we're brainwashing our students, if that's the case, we're not doing a very good job of it. You know, people who teach linear algebra, people who teach biology, they're not influenced by their political beliefs. I think there's a tendency sometimes to focus on a small slice of the university where you have people who are public intellectuals who are pronouncing on various things, not on behalf of the university, but on behalf of their own points of view.
But you would say to your students, you would encourage them to listen to people, to ideas that they may find uncomfortable.
Not only do I encourage them, I tell them it's our job. One cannot believe in truth unless you're willing to be proven wrong. We need to be able to model the behavior we would hope to see in the rest of the world. That if we can't figure out how to have difficult conversations at a place like Harvard, then there's really very little hope for the rest of the world.
It's part of that opening up somewhere like Harvard to a wider pool of students. And I'm thinking about people who get in because, for example, their parents donate huge amounts of money. Is it time for that to end?
I take issue with your characterization. We don't accept students simply because their parents donate huge amounts of money.
Well, some would argue otherwise. Some would say actually there is a proportion of places that is allocated to people who are prepared to donate huge sums.
People will say all sorts of things. You know, we had a lawsuit where the curtain was pulled back on our admissions process. We work very, very hard to make Harvard accessible to students regardless of the ability of their parents to pay. Student who comes to Harvard from a family with less than $65,000 a year in income, their parents pay literally nothing.
So donations aren't a factor at all. I mean, the New York Times talked about 33% the admission rate for legacy applicants.
Well, legacy applicants, I would tell you, first of all, are not the same as people who donate large amounts of money. They're people whose parents happen to have
alumni gone, as well then.
But you know, gone to Harvard.
Yeah. But that's entrenching privilege in its own way, isn't it?
Well, I would tell you that the real advantage that students have who are applying to Harvard are those who come from families who highly value education, who've worked hard to make sure that their sons and daughters have had access to a good high school education, who've exposed their children to a wide variety of activities, of interests, before they're even applying to college. It's less the issue of whether or not their parents went to Harvard than did their parents actually go someplace like Harvard. It could have been Cambridge or Oxford. It could have been Stanford or MIT. I take on a group of first-year students as advisees each year. One of my students this year happens to be a young woman who's undocumented, who was brought to this country by her parents when she was a child. She does not enjoy the status of citizenship. She comes from a family of exceedingly modest means, as one might imagine. She happens to be an exceedingly bright young woman who has worked very hard to get to where she is today, who has not had the advantages that so many other students have. Those are the kinds of kids that we want at Harvard, and we work very, very hard to recruit them, and we work very hard to support them.
Just one final thought. I mean, do you feel at all under siege in a world where populism seems to be the dominant theme at the moment? As an elite institution, I mean, I mean that in the best possible way, doing good research, attracting the best students, that those populist politicians look at you and say, you know, you don't understand what real people are about, what their real problems are. You're out of step.
We have faculty who work on every kind of problem that ails society. I think it's easy to cartoon what goes on in these institutions. I grew up in Pontiac, Michigan, a blue-collar town north of Detroit. I took my first trip as president of Harvard back to Pontiac, back to Detroit. And Pontiac has fallen on hard times. It's now the poorest city in the state of Michigan. I made a point of noting that the president of the major research university in Detroit, Wayne State University, was an alumnus of Harvard. That the superintendent of public schools for the city of Detroit was an alumnus of Harvard. That the head of the largest charitable organization in the area, the United Way, was an alumnus of Harvard. The point I want to make is that we have alumni working hard to strengthen communities throughout the heartland of the United States. Part of what I want to do is to make sure that people understand that we are there. Harvard exists to make the world a better place.
Lofty ambitions indeed. That was the president of Harvard University, Larry Barco. Bringing us to the end of this edition of News Air from me and the rest of the team here in London. Thanks for being with us. Until the next time, bye-bye.
NewsHour has been a download from the BBC. To discover more and our terms of use, visit bbc.com/podcasts.